You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this episode is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
For those looking to stay up to date in the personal injury and clinical negligence arena, LawPod UK has your back. So far this year, we've covered developments in the scope of duty since Cann and Meadows, the long-awaited Supreme Court decision on shock and secondary victims in Paul and Wolverhampton NHS Trust, and, if it's your thing, negligence in football, and I am studiously resisting the urge to mention the Euros. Staying on top of the law in this area requires constant attention, which is why I am delighted to have here with me John Whitting KC and Robert Mills, both of One Crown Office Row, to break down the decisions that clinical negligence lawyers really need to know about. John, you are very welcome back, and Rob, a warm welcome to the podcast for the first time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. It's nice to be here.
So first up, material contribution. An area of law which even the Court of Appeal recently acknowledged has been bedeviled by apparent inconsistency and imprecision at the highest level on multiple occasions. Rob, can you remind us what the fuss is all about on material contribution?
Yes, I'd be pleased to. So my best attempt to distill this terror of tort law into a digestible summary is as follows. That material contribution has relevance where there are multiple different causal factors feeding in to cause an injury. Some of them are negligent, some of them are non-negligent. And those factors have to be working cumulatively. They're combining together to cause the injury. They don't have to be the same type of causal factor. One could be a delay, another could be a pre-existing condition. And they don't have to happen at the same time. One can have its effect earlier or later than another in the timeline. Material contribution doesn't have any application where there are a number of possible causal factors feeding in isolation, with only one of them being the actual cause of the injury. But where the causal factors are cumulatively causing damage, if claimant can prove that on the balance of probabilities, the injury would have been avoided in the absence of negligence, notwithstanding some impact from non-negligent, then they succeed and they recover 100% of their damages. Similarly, if defendant can prove the opposite, that on balance, the injury would have been sustained in any event, regardless of the presence or some contribution from the negligent cause, then the defence succeeds and the claimant recovers no damages. But where that question can't be answered with clarity either way, where there's scientific uncertainty as to whether the injury would have been avoided or not in the absence of the negligent cause, and it can also be shown that that negligent cause has made a more than minimal contribution to the injury, then material contribution is established. And despite the claimant not being able to prove their case on the conventional balance of probabilities standard, material contribution means that they succeed and recover damages. Commonly, it will be said that they recover 100% in that scenario, and that's right, assuming that the injury is indivisible. In other words, you either have the injury or you don't. Once the causal factors have done their work, it's an all or nothing injury, as opposed to a dose-related condition whereby the injury worsens the more there is exposure to the particular causal factor. And if it is the latter, dose-related, then it's divisible. And if the court is able to apportion damages between non-negligent and negligent elements, then they will do so. And claimant recovers whatever the corresponding percentage of damages is. So that's a whistle-stop tour. It's right to say that divisible and indivisible distinctions is what's caused a lot of confusion, as we'll come on to, and we'll have a look at that in our recent case law when we analyse it. I hope that's clear.
I imagine I'm not the only one who feels like they need to go into a room and put a wet towel on my head. But if we look at this topic through the guise of the three cases that the courts have dealt with in the last 18 months. The first of those is CNZ and Royal Bath Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. Can you tell us a little bit about what that case was about?
So that was a decision in the High Court by Mr. Justice Ritchie. It was effectively an informed consent case. Judge held there that defendant was at fault for not offering the option of an elective caesarean section. Mr. Justice Ritchie held that mother would have accepted a caesarean section. Cerebral palsy would have been avoided entirely as a result. However, he held in the alternative, A, that the negligence made a material contribution, and B, as it was not possible to apportion between negligent and non-negligently caused ischemia, claimant would, even on the basis of material contribution, have been entitled to recover in full for the CP.
So what did the court have to say about material contribution?
Well, what the judge did first was he went on to explore whether apportionment was possible in this case. So he conducted a detailed analysis of how a court should approach indivisible as opposed to divisible injuries. And he drew the distinction between what are termed A, trigger injuries, and B, injuries which are dose related, so your divisible injuries. Brain damage caused by profound hypoxic ischemia or PHI is not a trigger disease. So Mr. Justice Ritchie, it doesn't grow like a cancer or mesothelioma once it's been triggered. The spread of the brain damage due to the PHI is very much dose dependent. So in that sense, in the conventional sense, it's a divisible injury, it's dose related. But the more PHI the fetus suffered, the greater the brain damage they're going to sustain. However, the term indivisible may apply to the functional outcome caused by one or more minutes of the acute PHI. And this is an important, somewhat new concept in the judicial commentary on material contribution. The functional outcome may be said to have more relevance than the nature of the injury itself in terms of quantum. So to assess the damages attributable to negligence in that scenario, he held that the court needed to decide whether the functional outcome, what it would have been in the absence of the negligent delay. He said on the basis that there's no linear relationship between minutes of acute hypoxia and functional outcome, science was unable to establish with generality, accuracy or detail the functional effects of each minute of brain cell deaths. It was scientifically impossible. So the functional outcome was indivisible, despite it being a condition which was dose-related in itself. So claimant was entitled, he found, to recover 100% of the damage caused by the PHI on the basis of the material contribution test. So that's potentially an evolution in the approach towards divisible injuries and material contribution.
And so that was a High Court decision. And we know that in November last year, the Court of Appeal handed down two judgments, both dealing with material contribution. One was Holmes and Potten Holdings LTD, and the other CDE and Surrey and Sussex Healthcare NHS Trust. Can you tell us about those cases?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Holmes case is another important one, Court of Appeal, which was clarifying or confirming that material contribution does apply to indivisible injuries. It's important that they did this because there were a couple of cases back in 2021, Thorley and Davies, which in effect cast doubt on whether material contribution did in fact apply to indivisible injuries. And the Court of Appeal very clear here that it does. So briefly, by way of background, a claimant in Holmes worked for a defendant for 38 years, was exposed to unsafe levels of trichloroethylene, an organic solvent, during his employment. And in 2014, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which he argued was an indivisible condition. He sued defendant for damages, alleging that his exposures to CCE had materially contributed to the Parkinson's. And at first instance, trial judge found that breaches of duty that led to claimant being exposed to TCE were established and went on to consider causation, found that TCE had created a material contribution to the risk of claimant suffering from Parkinson's disease, and defendant appealed, arguing that the evidence fell short of establishing that there was actually a contribution to the development as opposed to the risk of the development. This is an important point. What is required to establish the material nature of the contribution is risk enough? The Court of Appeal said no. So it was a helpful case, a welcome clarification of the doctrine, as I think most in the legal community have probably assumed it to be. It does apply to both the visible and indivisible injuries as a legal doctrine, material contribution. And it's also a reminder that the evidential bar for proving it isn't a low one, as is sometimes, I think, considered. Claimant has to prove both that the link is possible theoretically and actually there before they can succeed.
And so that leads us to CDE and Surrey and Sussex Healthcare NHS Trust. What, if anything, is interesting for clin-neg practitioners in that Court of Appeal case?
That's another CP case, cerebral palsy on the face of it. So very briefly, the facts: claimant suffered from quadriplegic CP following birth by emergency caesarean section. That C-section was as a result of an obstetrician identifying brachycardia when she entered the labour ward room. And it was agreed between the parties that the injury resulted from a short period of near total hypoxic ischemia. Claimant accepted CP would have occurred irrespective of negligence, and material contribution was the route to success if there was one. And by the time of the appeal hearing, claimant's case was that the attendance and so delivery would have been 1 minute earlier. So a very short period of time, but nonetheless, it was argued that would have made a material difference. Mr. Justice Ritchie, again, he dismissed the claim first instance. In essence, there was a breach of duty by delaying by 40 to 50 minutes in transferring mothers to the labour ward, but that made, he thought, no difference, because it wasn't until late in the timeline that CTG would have been bradycardic and prompted intervention by way of C-section. Court of Appeal unanimously allowed the appeal. That brought back into relevance the lost minute and whether that minute would have made a difference to the baby's condition. So that question was remitted to the trial judge to consider it and whether that had the capacity to represent a material contribution to a life-changing injury. It's an almost inevitable feature of those sort of cases that the evidence will evolve throughout the process of reports, joint statements, and the trial itself. So often unwise for a claimant to attach their position too firmly to any specific causation position or timeline. And indeed, they didn't do so here. And causation may often, I think, not crystallise properly until the judge has made specific findings as to the facts and to the breach. And CDE provided quite a vivid illustration of that. A material contribution as ever remitted, common issue in CP cases, and a reminder that even a minute can make a big difference.
And so in terms of the takeaway for practitioners from all three cases, is there a trend that you can point to, or is it simply the case that further judicial consideration of material contribution is highly likely?
I think there will be further judicial consideration of it, but I think we've got helpful clarification, particularly in terms of the Holmes case. It's now understood that this is a concept which is relevant to indivisible injuries, and that's important because a lot of the time in clinical negligence, that's what we're looking at. Whether the CNZ mechanism of looking at functional outcomes rather than the nature of injuries themselves will be something which is revolutionary in itself, we'll have to see. But it certainly provides claimant with another helpful route to try and get 100% of their damages, even if they are looking at a more classically divisible condition. So I'm sure more litigation to follow. It is a maze of tort law, as I say, but 2023 was a helpful year for some level of clarification.
And so, switching subject now, John is going to update us about patient autonomy and recent developments in the judicial treatment of informed consent. But first, a little bit of background. In 2022, John and I published an episode covering various updates since the Supreme Court decision in Montgomery, and we discussed a number of cases, including Juice. Encouragingly, or alarmingly, depending on how you see it, nearly 6,000 people listened to that episode. One of the issues we covered was the concern within the medical profession that Montgomery appeared to require every clinician, no matter their status, experience, or speciality, to have comprehensive knowledge of every conceivable treatment known to the worldwide community and to advise patients about these. John's analysis then was that in Deuce, the Court of Appeal reintroduced the concept of the reasonably competent doctor, that is, the Bolam test, to at least one element of consent. Today, he's going to tell us about two more recent decisions, one from the Court of Appeal and one from the Supreme Court. So, John, what is new in the law of informed consent?
Thank you, Emma. So I'm going to start with the Court of Appeal judgment in the case of Bilal and St. George's University Hospital, where the claimant underwent elective surgery to the thoracic and lumbar spine. No criticism was made of the quality of surgery performed, but unfortunately, the outcome for the claimant was a significant clinical deterioration. He suffered a paraparesis and would be wheelchair dependent for the remainder of his life, and sadly, he died a few years later. The allegations at trial were that he was inadequately consented, including a failure to recognize that the pain was neuropathic rather than radicular, failing to recommend that the scope of surgery be limited to the lumbar spine, and failing to discuss or recommend alternative non-surgical treatments. So advised, it is said, he would not have undergone surgery at all, or not as extensive, and he would not have suffered any complications as a result. At trial, the judge was very impressed by the evidence of the surgeon, and the defendant won on all counts. And insofar as relevant for wider consideration, the judge found that the surgeon was not obliged to offer alternatives, including nerve root injections or other conservative pain management treatments, which he did not consider in his professional opinion were an appropriate or a sufficient response to the claimant's presentation. By the time of the appeal, the claimant's case was essentially that the surgeon had taken insufficient steps to ascertain the duration of the intercostal pain, and therefore that the advice given had been on a false premise. As Lady Justice Nicola Davis pointed out, this was not a pleaded particular of negligence, nor had it been pursued in cross-examination, of which she took a dim view, and in any event, she found that the evidence was actually against the claimant on the point, and so the appeal failed on that basis alone. So her observations about the law of consent were strictly obiter. They are, however, worth noting because she confirmed that whether or not something is a, quote, reasonable alternative or variant treatment, to use the wording of Montgomery, and should therefore be offered to or discussed with the patient, is a Bolam question. In other words, the clinician isn't under any obligation to offer or discuss every possible treatment modality, only those which in their clinical judgment would be appropriate in that particular case. And Lady Justice Davis made clear that the only matter which falls outside the scope of Bolam and which is reserved exclusively to the court rather than to expert evidence is whether a risk would have been material to the particular patient. So appeal dismissed and a win for the defendants.
And then a few short weeks later, the Supreme Court looked at this issue in another case called McCulloch.
It did. Mr. McCulloch died of a cardiac arrest, and his widow alleged that his death was caused by the negligence of a consultant cardiologist employed by the Defendant Health Board. And among other things, it was said that there was a failure, contrary to a Montgomery obligation to do so, to discuss the option of using non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs with Mr. McCulloch. The claim failed at first instance and in the inner house of the Court of Session. Both courts held that the duty of Montgomery does not require a doctor to discuss a course of treatment with their patient if the doctor has concluded, applying their professional skill and judgment, that it is not a reasonable option in the circumstances of the case, and the doctor's view is supported by a responsible body of medical opinion. And so the appeal came before the Supreme Court. And interestingly, both the BMA and GMC were interveners, and there is no doubt in my mind at all that their contributions had a significant impact on the court, not least by describing the reality of clinical practice and the implications that Montgomery and perhaps the more purist interpretations of the judgment has had for doctors in their day-to-day lives. Anyway, the claimant argued that following Deuce, the Court of Appeal judgment, which we've discussed before on this podcast, the only aspect of the Montgomery test that was or should be the subject of Bolam analysis was the extent to which an individual clinician should have been aware of all of the alternative treatments and the risks and benefits inherent in each, and that once that was established, the law then required the clinician to discuss all of them with the patient. And the Supreme Court disagreed. It ruled, as had the Court of Appeal in Bihar a few weeks earlier, that a doctor who has taken the view that a treatment is not a reasonable alternative for a particular patient will not be negligent in failing to inform the patient of that alternative treatment if the doctor's view is supported by a responsible body of medical opinion. And to illustrate their thinking, they gave a hypothetical example, which I'm going to quote. Let us then say that in respect of a diagnosis, there are 10 possible treatment options, and that there is a responsible body of medical opinion that would regard each of the 10 as possible treatment options. Let us then say that the doctor, exercising his or her clinical judgment and supported by a responsible body of medical opinion, decides that only 4 of them are reasonable. The doctor is not negligent by failing to inform the patient about the other 6, even though they are possible alternative treatments. The narrowing down from possible alternative treatments to reasonable alternative treatments is an exercise of clinical judgment to which the professional practice test should be applied. The duty of reasonable care would then require the doctor to inform the patient not only of the treatment option that the doctor is recommending, but also of the other 3 reasonable alternative treatment options, indicating their respective advantages and disadvantages and the material risks involved in such treatment options. And they went on. It is important to stress that it is not being suggested that the doctor can simply inform the patient about the treatment option or options that the doctor himself or herself prefers. Rather, the doctor's duty of care, in line with Montgomery, is to inform the patient of all reasonable treatment options applying the professional practice test. And they went on to say this, and here you can certainly see how they were influenced by what they were told by the interveners about real-world medicine. If we were to reject the professional practice test in determining reasonable alternative treatments, one consequence would be an unfortunate conflict in the exercise of a doctor's role. This is because the law would be requiring a doctor to inform a patient about an alternative medical treatment, which the doctor, exercising professional skill and judgment and supported by a responsible body of medical opinion, would not consider to be a reasonable medical option. And that, of course, was precisely one of the dilemmas we were discussing on our last podcast together, Emma.
That's quite right. And I suppose the question then, following this decision by the Supreme Court, and a significant one following Montgomery, is this a return to sense or is it a regression to medical paternalism?
So I'm old enough to remember the confident predictions that Montgomery marked the end of Bolam and that the courts would no longer need expert witnesses to determine clinical negligence cases. We have travelled a long way since then, and I've been lucky enough to be involved in some of the cases which have formed the stepping stones to where we find ourselves now, which I think is this. If we can deconstruct the Montgomery test, which, just to remind ourselves, is this, a duty to take reasonable care to ensure that the patient is aware of any material risks involved in any recommended treatment and of any reasonable alternative or variant treatments, and ask ourselves which are now matters of expert evidence and or subject to Bolam analysis and which are exclusively reserved to the court. Number one, what are the reasonable alternative or variant treatments for this particular patient? That's expert evidence in Bolam. Two, what are the risks of such treatments and should they have been known to the clinician? Again, expert evidence in Bolam. Three, is the quantum of any such risk sufficient to render it material? Expert evidence in Bolam. And four, if so, would this patient have considered any such risk to be material? And that is a matter for the court. So I think we've probably now hit the sweet spot on informed consent, or to put it another way, just about the right balance between patient autonomy and the reality of clinical practice.
I hope that the medical profession will be breathing a sigh of relief after that case, because certainly some of the blog articles were rather alarmist following some of the developments that preceded Montgomery. Finally then, an update on the pitfalls of expert evidence. This podcast has previously covered this topic with Margaret Byron KC and Neil Sheldon KC, episodes which I highly recommend to anyone preparing for trial. In June this year, Mrs. Justice Lambert handed down her ruling in Woods and Doncaster and Bassett Law Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which is quite a mouthful. The case concerned the management of pregnancy and labour, during which the claimant was starved of oxygen and as a result was born with significant brain injury. Much turned on the expert evidence concerning obstetric care and whether the claimant's mother should have been induced earlier. Of interest to us, Mrs. Justice Lambert had a number of things to say about the quality, or lack thereof, of the expert evidence before her. John, what were your thoughts reading this case?
Well, Emma, the first thing that struck me was this. We've all seen and appeared in cases where the expert is inexperienced, out of their depth, or lacks the appropriate expertise, and it all falls apart. Here, the expert under the microscope was none of those things. He is hugely experienced and respected both clinically and medico-legally. He's been my expert witness in countless cases and in many trials. I've always been very impressed with him. And yet, things went very badly. And I think it's a salutary reminder that no one is immune from criticism. And it's also a salutary reminder of how critically important the presentation of an expert's written and oral evidence is at trial. And also, the responsibility for that ultimately lies with the trial advocate. And trial advocacy is probably worth a podcast all on its own. But I think for these purposes, the key considerations that I would take into account or share are these. Never serve your expert's evidence without having made sure it has expressly taken account of all of the relevant evidence and all of the issues between the parties as they stand at the time that that evidence is served. never put your expert in the witness box without having robustly taken them through every argument or point that they might realistically face in cross-examination, and without satisfying yourself that their answers stack up to skeptical scrutiny. And in short, never rely on your expert to get their evidence into shape fit for trial. That is your job, not theirs.
It was certainly an alarming reminder of what can go wrong in so many ways in a trial involving expert evidence. I have to say that reading Woods reminded me, and although this case is very different, it did remind me of a case before the Upper Tribunal in 2023 called CE in Cameroon, which listeners may or may not have come across. But that dealt with the alleged psychiatric harm the claimant would suffer if returned to Cameroon. And in that case, the Upper Tribunal severely criticised Dr. Nguyen Galapathy, a consultant forensic psychiatrist, for his failure to engage with the medical opinion provided by the claimant's healthcare team and his failure to provide any reasoning as to why his opinion differed from the claimant's GP records. The Upper Tribunal found that no weight could be placed on his expert opinion. So far, that isn't unusual. But the Upper Tribunal then took the step of concluding the judgment by saying the following: having considered the risk assessment filed in this matter, we do not consider Dr. Galapathy to have provided objective and expert evidence. Whilst he may in future provide opinion that is sufficiently reasoned and impartial to establish his objectivity and expertise, we agree that our conclusion in this matter can properly be considered by this tribunal and the first-tier tribunal in respect of any future risk assessment opinion he prepares. So what the court did there was essentially flag up this particular expert and his expertise for future cases. And so, Rob, I wonder, do you think that courts are generally becoming more explicitly critical with experts who fail to live up to their Part 35 duties?
Yes, I think they probably are. There's been a number of judgments in recent years that have been very critical of experts. We've even seen examples of cost orders being made against experts. Some might say rightly so. Experts are the foundation of clinical negligence litigation. It's on the basis of their evidence that claims are brought and defended. And it's an expensive process. A lot of work goes into it from the legal teams. It's a stressful process for both claimants and clinicians, especially where the case reaches trial. So the Part 35 obligations are important to ensure that those expert foundations are laid appropriately and cases should be reaching trial where there's a genuine difference in carefully considered medical opinion or legal opinion, if it's a case on which that turns. But I've been involved in a couple of trials this year where deficiencies in an expert's report, which could and should have been picked up before service, have served to undermine that expert's evidence as a whole. And yes, it's good ammunition for us as barristers, and there's a degree of professional satisfaction in exploiting it, I suppose. But it's the key message, as John's laid out, for case preparation.
I think, just to echo what you said, Emma, the trouble is these things have a really long tail, because you know that the next time that any expert appears in court, you know, whether it's question one or whether you spring it as a nice surprise halfway through to destabilize them, what the judge said about them in a previous case is going to come up. And, you know, it won't be binding on the subsequent trial judge, but it's pretty prejudicial and it certainly undermines what they're saying. There have been a couple of cases in the last, I suppose, 3 years, and there was one quantum case where there was very explicit and rigorous criticism of certain quantum experts who I know now have just simply given up and they won't now appear or give expert evidence. So I think obviously it's a shared responsibility when it comes to giving evidence, but I think experts need to be aware when they give evidence that they should assume that one day they might be asked to justify what they're saying in a courtroom, and the fact that most trials or most cases settle shouldn't blind them to that fact. Everything should be prepared with the same degree of rigor as if they're going to be standing up in court tomorrow.
I very much agree. Those precise issues were covered both with Margaret and with Neil in the episodes I've referred to. So thank you both for that tour through the clinical negligence cases that anyone practicing in this area ought to know, and be aware of. We will link, as we always do, to the cases and podcast episodes referenced in today's podcast. And all that remains for me to do is to thank you both very much for coming on the podcast and breaking down with some pith and concision what are very difficult concepts. Thank you.
Thanks.
Not at all. Thank you.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.